from CBS News in Washington, Face the Nation with Bob Schieffer.
Today on Face the Nation, the crisis in Ukraine intensifies.
With Russian forces in Crimea, Ukrainians call up their military reserves and beg the international community for help.
We are on the brink of the disaster.
We'll go to Ukraine for the latest news. We'll hear from Secretary of State John Kerry and Secretary of Defense Chuck Hagel. We'll have analysis on all of it from a panel of experts. And with Russia once more in the news, we'll look back at a milestone Face the Nation interview. 60 years of news, because this is Face the Nation.
Good morning again. Well, there are developments from overnight on the crisis in Ukraine. Russian President Vladimir Putin has moved troops into Crimea. That is a region with a mostly Russian-speaking population, a move that the Ukrainian prime minister says is a declaration of war. Vladimir Putin and President Obama spoke yesterday for 90 minutes, a conversation the White House described as the toughest of the Obama presidency. As for Ukraine, a new government there is mobilizing its reserves and authorizing the call-up of all men under the age of 40. CBS News correspondent Charlie Daggett is in Kiev this morning. Charlie, people are again out in the square. What's going on there?
Yeah, Bob, there are about 1,000 demonstrators and protests that arrived here. The numbers have swollen since the situation in Crimea. Today we've been hearing them saying, down with Russian President Vladimir Putin. They're calling him a liar and a dictator. The Ukrainian prime minister said that the country is on the brink of disaster and they're preparing for war. And the way they've done that is they put the standing military, 130,000 people or so, on high alert. But they've also put the call out to reserves using websites and radio, saying to stand by for further information and instruction. They may have to go to military centers around Kiev and around Ukraine and report for duty, fighting men under 40 years old. Now, we haven't seen, it doesn't feel like this area itself is under threat. There's no military presence at the airport or around the squares or on the roads. But the real concern is around the eastern border, along the border with Russia, where you have a lot of Russian-speaking people, a lot of Russian loyalties. And the concern is whether Russian troops will advance in those areas, and more importantly, what Ukrainian forces can do, if anything, to defend against that.
All right, Charlie, thank you so much. CBS News foreign correspondent Elizabeth Palmer is in southern Ukraine this morning, and she is en route to the Crimea region. Liz, what's the latest?
Thousands of Russian troops are fanning out over the Crimean Peninsula, taking control. They're uniformed, and they are setting up at strategic locations. Many of them were based in the Crimea anyway, with the Russian Black Sea Fleet on a lease agreement with the Ukraine. Well, they've left the bases and they're out on active duty. Also, it appears that some hundreds of soldiers have been brought in from elsewhere in Russia. Now, not a shot has been fired. This has been very peaceful. In fact, a lot of the people, Russian-speaking, pro-Russian population of Crimea, have welcomed those troops and their mission, which, according to Vladimir Putin, is to protect the Russian-speaking population.
And I understand you've had quite an eventful trip en route to the Crimea.
That's right, Bob. We drove a long way from Kiev and finally got to this rather informal border across the neck that leads onto the Crimean Peninsula. And there was a barricade in the road manned by what we thought were Ukrainian troops. Well, it turns out these guys had switched sides. They'd hoisted the Russian flag at their barricade, and they were backed up by a group of local men in camouflage gear, also armed, who came and raided our truck, took our gear apart, and stole our body armor. Not only did they steal it, they put it on right away, helmets and flak jackets, walked off with it and told us to get out of there, that they weren't going to let us in.
Okay, well, be careful for the rest of the trip, Liz, and we'll check in with you later today. We are joined now by Secretary of State John Kerry, who is in Boston this morning. Mr. Secretary, thank you for being here. The Ukrainian Prime Minister says this morning that Russia's actions amount to a declaration of war, and he says we are on the brink of disaster. Do you agree with that?
Well, it's an incredible act of aggression. It is really a stunning
willful choice by President Putin to invade another country. Russia is in violation of the sovereignty of Ukraine. Russia is in violation of its international obligations. Russia is in violation of its obligations under the UN Charter, under the Helsinki Final Act. It's a violation of its obligations under the 1994 Budapest Agreement. You just don't, in the 21st century, behave in 19th century fashion by invading another country on completely trumped-up pretext. So it is a very serious moment. But it's serious not in the context, Bob, of Russia, U.S. It's serious in terms of sort of the modern manner with which nations are going to resolve problems. There are all kinds of other options still available to Russia. There still are. President Obama wants to emphasize to the Russians that there is a right set of choices that can still be made to address any concerns they have about Crimea, about their citizens. But you don't choose to invade a country in order to do that.
The president spoke to Vladimir Putin, we're told, for 90 minutes yesterday. The White House is describing it as the toughest phone call of his presidency. Do you think it had any impact?
Well, we're going to have to wait and see. But I think it was a very important conversation. The president was very strong. He made absolutely clear that this was unacceptable and that there will be serious repercussions if this stands. The president asked Mr. Putin, in fact, told Mr. Putin it was imperative to find a different path to roll back this invasion and undo this act of aggression. He pointed out the many different ways in which Russia could have chosen to act. I mean, if you have legitimate concerns about your citizens, go to the United Nations, ask for observers, engage the other country's government. There were any number of choices available to Russia. Russia chose this brazen act of aggression and moved in with its forces on a completely trumped up set of a pretext, claiming that people were threatened. And the fact is that that's not the act of somebody who is strong. That's the act of somebody who is acting out of weakness and out of certain kind of desperation. We hope that Russia will turn this around. They can. Again and again, all week, President Obama and I and others have insisted that we believe there's a way to deal with this issue. This doesn't have to be a zero-sum game. It is not Russia versus the United States, Russia v. Europe. This is about the people of Ukraine. The people of Ukraine are the people who initiated what is happening there. Their president, Yanukovych, supported by Russia, lost all support, all legitimacy. He fled in the night. His own supporters deserted him. They went to their parliament, and they voted according to their parliamentary process. So this is a democratic process that has placed this new government where it is, and President Putin and Russia ought to respect that.
Mr. Secretary, when you come right down to it, the president says there's a cost, and I suppose there are certain diplomatic things you could do. You could boycott the G8 and so on. But when you come right down to it, what can we really do here? I mean, I don't suppose anybody thinks we're going to declare war on Russia here and send military forces in there.
Well, there are very serious repercussions that can flow out of this. There are broad array of options that are available, not just to the United States, but to our allies. I spent yesterday afternoon on the phone with many of my counterparts. I talked to 10 of the foreign ministers of those countries most engaged, the G8 plus some others. And all of them, every single one of them, are prepared to go to the hilt in order to isolate Russia with respect to this invasion. They're prepared to put sanctions in place. They're prepared to isolate Russia economically. The ruble is already going down. Russia has major economic challenges. I can't imagine that an occupation of another country is something that appeals to people who are trying to reach out to the world. And particularly if it involves violence, I think they're going to be inviting major difficulties for the long term. The people of Ukraine will not sit still for this. They know how to fight. They've demonstrated remarkable bravery, Bob. I mean, you think about Yanukovych positioning his snipers on the rooftops of Kiev, and notwithstanding people falling to the right and to the left, these marchers kept on marching, and they demanded their freedom. They demanded their opportunity to have their voices heard without a kleptocracy and a tyranny governing them. I think Russia needs to think very carefully about the choice that it's making. And there are visa bans, there are asset freezes, there is isolation with respect to trade and investment. American businesses may well want to start thinking twice about whether they want to do business with a country that behaves like this. These are serious implications. And I know from my conversations yesterday, every one of our allies and friends are determined to stay united and to make clear there is a price attached to this kind of behavior.
Are we actually prepared, Mr. Secretary, to boycott the G8 meeting there?
Well, we're absolutely prepared to if we can't resolve it otherwise. But the preference of the president, myself, the entire administration, is to resolve this. We're not trying to make this a battle between East and West. We don't want to return to the Cold War. Nobody wants this kind of action. There are many ways to resolve this problem. As President Obama urged President Putin yesterday, this is the moment to engage directly with the government of Ukraine. This can be resolved. We're prepared to mediate, to help. We're prepared to provide economic assistance of a major sort. We want the Congress to join us in providing that assistance. We hope that this can be resolved according to the standards of the 21st century and, frankly, according to the standards of the G8. If Russia wants to be a G8 country, it needs to behave like a G8 country. And I guarantee you that everybody is determined that if this cannot be resolved in a reasonable, modern, 21st century manner, there are going to be repercussions.
All right. Well, Mr. Secretary, thank you so much for joining us this morning.
Thank you.
When we talked to Secretary of Defense Chuck Hagel on Friday, he said flatly it would be a mistake for the Russians to cross the border into Ukraine.
It's serious. We continue to talk with the Russians. I just came back from a NATO ministerial meeting a couple of days ago, as you know. That was much the topic of the conversation there. Strong support from all 28 members of NATO of Ukraine, their territorial integrity, their independence. This is a time for careful, wise, steady leadership. The tensions increase, and I think all nations have to be very careful here of not promoting any more tension through provocative action. So we're very close to it. We stay very close to it.
What would we do if the Russians' forces started rolling into other parts of Ukraine?
Well, I won't get into the different specific options, but this could be a very dangerous situation if this continues in a very provocative way. We have many options, like any nations do. We're trying to deal with the diplomatic focus. That's the appropriate, responsible approach, and that's what we're going to continue to do.
But we do have a plan.
Well, we have plans for everything all the time.
When you come right down to it, what can we really do there?
Well, again, we've got different options, but for right now, the responsible thing is to continue to work through the diplomatic channels, and that's what we're doing.
What is our strategic interest in Ukraine?
Well, first, it's a sovereign, independent nation, and we support that sovereignty and that independence. They have been a responsible new independent member of the global community since the implosion of the Soviet Union. We have European Union and NATO interests that border Ukraine. These are people who want to be free. who deserve to be freed, deserve their own way of life, the elected leaders. And so, like our position with any sovereign free nation, that's the principle upon which the United States stands. And I think all Western countries in respecting people's rights, and that's where you start.
This, in your view, would be a mistake for the Russians if they decided to go into the Ukraine?
I think it would be a mistake, and this would set in motion so many different dynamics that are not in anyone's interest.
We'll have a lot more of our interview with Secretary Hagel in part two of Face the Nation, more on the crisis in Ukraine in 1 minute. We're back now with David Ignatius of the Washington Post and CBS News national security correspondent David Martin over at the White House this morning, our chief White House correspondent, Major Garrett. Major, you did considerable reporting yesterday on the president's phone call to Putin. You said officials were telling you this was the toughest phone call of his administration. What are they thinking about over there this morning? What do they see as what might happen here?
Well, Bob, the White House knows that Putin has the facts on the ground. He has a military force in the Crimea. What the United States and its European partners have is international law, international norms, and the threat of pronounced economic isolation for Russia if it continues with what Secretary of State Kerry just called a brazen breach of international law. Now, the reason the administration uses that phraseology is because that's what Vladimir Putin conspicuously and constantly talks about in other parts of the world, Syria, Iran. It's always talking about other nations, specifically the United States, following international norms. Well, the United States is now calling Russia out on its behavior, saying you're violating the self-same standards you constantly seek to hold the rest of the world to. And if you continue with this behavior, you are going to be isolated not only diplomatically, but economically. And right now, the administration is working behind the scenes to have this IMF team, International Monetary Fund team, that's due to arrive in Kiev later this week, not just come there to say hello, but have a specific aid package for the Ukrainians to say the West is here to help you economically. And as it has with the situation in Crimea, the administration will invite the Russians in. Look, participate internationally if you have legitimate concerns about the Russians in Crimea. But if you don't, your isolation, economically and diplomatically, will only increase. And the White House believes that is a greater force of leverage than they believe Putin has, even though he has the forces on the ground in Crimea.
All right. Well, thank you very much, Major. David, what's happening militarily? I don't think anybody, as I said to Secretary Kerry, and he didn't dispute this, nobody's thinking about going to war with Russia right now. Is there any kind of military movement in that part of the world right now?
Not
ships
on,
or anything like that?
Not on the part of the United States. The only movement right now is Russian troops continue to flow into Crimea. It's hard to put a number on it, but whatever the number, it's a fait accompli. And you notice that Secretary Kerry said, if this stands, he did not say, this shall not stand, as George H.W. Bush once said of the invasion of Kuwait. The U.S. has no military options. It has no treaty obligations to come to the defense of Ukraine. Putin knows that, and that is why he has acted so decisively. The big question is whether he is going to order Russian troops into the rest of Ukraine. That would turn what is now a crisis into, I think, a full-scale
disaster.
Well,
explain to us exactly what's happened here. The Russians have a base. They have a military base in Crimea. There are Russian troops there already. Apparently, some of them have moved outside of the base now, but they haven't moved beyond the borders of Crimea.
That's right. They haven't crossed over where Liz Palmer was standing into the rest of Ukraine. And This morning's intelligence is that there is no sign that they are preparing to do that, which is, in the context of everything else that's happened, very good news.
So, David, how do you assess what's happened so far and what happens now?
Well, I think we saw the parameters of U.S. policy in the interviews with Secretary Kerry and Secretary Hagel. Secretary Kerry used very strong language, a brazen act of aggression, violation of international law. He called on the Russians to roll back this invasion. But when you got down to the specific tools, the ways in which the United States will make Russia pay a cost for what it's done. These are milder diplomatic options. As David said, I'm told by my sources in the Pentagon, there is no ship moving in the Mediterranean. There are no NATO troops moving on the landmass of Europe. We are not preparing for military response. If you're talking about rollback, you're talking about Putin realizing that this course, which reanimates Cold War psychology in Eastern Europe, is not in his interest. And I do think the final point to add here is the real problem today is Vladimir Putin's. Vladimir Putin has a Ukraine that is coming apart. He has invaded a small southern piece of it where Russian interests are very strong. But in the Ukrainian capital, you have demonstrators in the streets. These are demonstrators who evicted a pro-Russian regime in the Ukraine, and they're not prepared to go backwards. So I the choices Putin faces going forward are very, very bad.
Well, explain to me about the Crimea. It is a part of Ukraine, but someone said to me last night, it's very much like San Diego. You have a large retired military population there, mostly Russians. A lot of the people there speak Russian, and most of the people there are pro-Russian. You heard Liz Palmer say that a lot of these soldiers change sides here.
Crimea became part of Ukraine only in 1954. Crimea was historically a part of Russia, and Khrushchev, when he was the Soviet leader, gave it to Ukraine in a gesture that mystified some people. But what you say is true. I don't know if it's San Diego, but it is where the Russians have their biggest naval base, where a lot of retirees go. People speak Russian, so it's a part of Ukraine that looks toward Moscow.
Let me stress, I didn't mean that there are a lot of communists in San Diego. I meant there's a large retired military population there, and it's a very, very conservative place. So what happens now, David?
Well, you have this base of the Russians in Crimea, which is a valuable strategic asset for them. This is their way to get out into the Mediterranean, to go to places like Syria. And I don't think they're going to pull out of there until they're satisfied that those bases are secure for the indefinite future.
What does Putin want here?
This action in Crimea and over Ukraine follows a series of efforts by Putin to reestablish, you know, the spirit, if you will, of the Soviet Union, if not the actual physical possession of those republics. I mean, the Sochi Olympics was a kind of exercise in nostalgia for the good old days of Soviet power. And so I think the danger here is if Putin is tempted to think that he can reoccupy countries like Ukraine. He did invade Georgia in 2008. Again, an attempt to assert Russian power in its neighborhood. If he has this romance of bringing things back to the way they used to be, that is trouble. That does take us back to the Cold War.
Well, I'm not sure that he really would take Ukraine back. I mean, this place is an economic basket case. Well, he wants to have influence there. He wants to control events there, but it also carries a pretty good price.
This is not the Soviet military of the Cold War. This is a much reduced and a much weakened military, which in the past, 5 years has been starting to make a comeback. But he's got to be careful about how much he bites off here. I mean, Crimea is one thing. You know, Ukraine would be an entirely different operation.
All right. We have a lot more to talk about on this, but we'll take a break right here, and we'll be back. We'll have a lot more on the crisis in Ukraine, plus part two of our interview with Secretary Hagel coming up on Face the Nation, so stay with us. Some of our stations are leaving us now, but for most of you, we'll be right back with a lot more Face the Nation, including analysis on the crisis in Ukraine with Danielle Pletka of the American Enterprise Institute, Michael O'Hanlon of the Brookings Institute. Plus, Defense Secretary Hagel talks about scaling back the military. Stay with us. And welcome back to Face the Nation, page two. You know, one irony of this week is that all of this story, the Ukraine story, broke just after Secretary of Defense Hagel had announced plans to scale back the American military. We're going to pick up the interview there. I want to talk to you about the military budget that you outlined. You want to reduce the size of the Army to the smallest size since before World War II. How do you reduce the size of the American military without making it look like to the people around the world that we're somehow retreating, that we're withdrawing from all of this?
You start, Bob, with the reality of where we are in the world today. This budget, that it is the first budget in 12 years that's not a budget based on war footing. We've been at war for 13 years constantly, two wars. We're out of one war, Iraq, and we're coming out of the longest war we've ever been, Afghanistan. Not unlike after every war the United States has been in, you reset your posture, you reset your assets, you reset your whole enterprise based on the new realities and based on preparing that institution for the challenges of the future. But answer your question, then, how do you adjust to the dangerous, complicated world that we're in? We've increased, for example, cyber assets, increased special operations. We're focusing on readiness, capability, our capacity, our ability to do the things that we need to do in the strategic interests of the strategic guidance that the president laid out in 2012.
You say we're coming out of two wars, and yes, that's true. But we're not necessarily coming away victors. We're just coming out of those wars. The enemy is still out there.
Of course, the threats are out there. Of course, the threats are shifting. Cyber is a good example. 5 years ago, there wasn't the same focus or reality of what a cyber attack could do to this country, paralyze this country, bring our economy down without any nation firing a shot, not knowing where it comes from. Special operations, the terrorist threat that still is around the world will be with us, I suspect, for some time. We've got to figure out how best we do that. The strategic priorities that we've laid out based on the president's strategic guidance plan: first, defend the homeland; second, continue to build capacity in securing our world through our alliances, through our treaty obligations, through our commitments all over the world, not retreating from the world. We're still going to be there. Also, defeating aggression in the world and winning a war against any adversary anywhere in the world. That hasn't changed. But how you do it, Bob, how you do it is always going to be adjusted to the realities of the time and the challenge.
But you're not suggesting in any way, shape, or form that we have won these wars. You're just saying we have to recalibrate the way we continue to fight them.
At the peak of Iraq, we had 150,000 troops in Iraq, that war. The peak of Afghanistan, probably around 120,000. Those are big numbers. And we don't need those as you go forward the same way we did the last 13 years. So you've got to adjust your force posture. And by the way, it isn't me cutting the budget. It's the Congress's decision on sequestration. So it isn't Secretary of Defense or the president doing this. And I think we should clear that up a little bit here, too. Where are we making decisions? And how do we make them? That's a responsibility I have. But also the fiscal constraints that are being placed on the Pentagon to make very tough choices here are very significant. So what we're talking about is gradually reducing our active duty strength by about 10%. I mean, I don't think that's an astoundingly large cut as we adjust, and we're still going to need a big army.
Let me ask you about something that your critics are saying, and they say that because you are proposing cuts in benefits, tax breaks, eliminating or slowing down pay raises for some of those on military duty, that you are in fact trying to balance the budget on the backs of these people who fought these wars.
Well, first of all, That's just not true. We're not making any recommendations on any retirement changes. We're going to wait till a retirement commission comes in. It was impaneled by the Congress on what we need to do, if we need to do anything on retirement. This isn't just an arbitrary unilateral approach to trying to slow the growth just to slow the growth. We've got to look at the long-term commitments to our people. Half of our budget today in the Pentagon goes to pay, compensation, retirement, medical care. And that will increase significantly. We're not cutting, we're proposing slowing growth in certain areas. And the tax cuts, we're not cutting anybody's taxes, but we are asking for specific considerations in areas where we are slowly, eventually reducing the growth of pay increases. There'll be still pay increases. And then other areas. We think these are responsible. We don't think it breaks faith with our people. But we have to reset, reposition. I've got to be able to keep a modern military. Those coming in behind me, the technological edge that has made our military the envy of the world, along with everything else, best led, best trained, best equipped, best educated. We want to sustain that for our own interest and for our people.
You can see more of our interview with Secretary Hagel, plus a response from New York Democrat Kirsten Gillibrand, who's not happy with some of the positions he has taken, especially on sexual assaults in the military. You can see all of that on our website at facethenation.com. And we'll be back in 1 minute with more on the Ukraine. Before we get to our panel, let's update on the latest developments on the crisis in Ukraine. NATO officials are now holding an emergency session in Brussels to discuss the latest developments. In Russia, at least 10,000 people marched in a pro-invasion rally through the streets of downtown Moscow. We're joined now again by David Ignatius of the Washington Post, along with Danielle Pletka of the American Enterprise Institute. David Martin, we ask him to stay back. And we're also joined by Michael O'Hanlon of the Brookings Institution. Danielle, let me just start with you. You heard Secretary Kerry. You heard Secretary Hagel. This is a morning when we heard a lot of news. I mean, a lot of developments here this morning. What did you make of what the Secretary said this morning?
Well, I thought the Secretary's rhetoric was very strong. The President's rhetoric was very strong. The problem really is that you've got to match strong rhetoric with strong actions. I don't mean military actions, but I do mean a decisive message to the Russians, more than just words, that is going to stop them in their steps, stop them not only from moving further into Crimea, but moving into the rest of Ukraine.
Well, he had some strong words there. He said, you know, he talked about the G8, he talked about these various things they can do. What can you do beyond that?
I think there are a lot of options for the United States and for our NATO allies. First of all, there are economic sanctions. We could certainly put the sanctions that we took off of Iran on Russia, maybe some banking sanctions that would target Russia's leadership. We can isolate the Russian economy. Another important thing we could do is we could free up and start selling gas to Europe, something that the Russians have been earning a great deal of money on and that we, the United States, are now not doing. So I think that there are numerous non-military options for us out there. The problem is, I don't think that the president right now is very credible. And I think that Putin thinks he's got Obama's number. And so he's going to do what he wants to do and dare the president for the next step.
Michael, what's your take on Secretary Kerry this morning?
I thought he was very good. But I guess overall, the point I'd want to emphasize, I'm a little more relaxed about this than most people for a couple of reasons. First of all, as bad as what Putin, you know, has been doing may be, he hasn't killed people. And I think he's trying to show force in a way that gets a specific task done. He wants his base. And I don't admire that approach. It is sort of 19th century-ish, as Secretary Kerry said. But it's not totally surprising for the way great powers behave, even in this century. And on top of that, we do have a pretty strong set of potential economic sanctions, and Putin knows it. And we've gotten a lot better in the last 10 years at applying sanctions, largely because of the Iran experience. We know how to go after the banking sector. We know how to go after visas and personal accounts of leaders in Russia if we need to. And so if this really escalates to a very bad kind of thing, which it hasn't yet, but if it got into civil warfare and an invasion by Russia to back up one side in Ukraine, then I think these kinds of tools would be applied, and they'd be applied effectively, and Putin knows it. So I'm relatively confident he won't go there.
You know, I want to pick up on something you said a while ago, David, and that was you said this, when you come around, this is Putin's problem. It's not the problem of the West. Well, obviously it has repercussions for the West, but give me a little more detail on that.
If we look back several months, we see that Putin has been facing a rebellion on his border in Ukraine, which is a country of absolutely crucial strategic importance to Russia. Many Russians feel a deep kinship. That's where the Orthodox Church was born. We've seen a movement turning west toward Europe. Putin tried to buy off the government of President Yanukovych, offering them $15 billion in assistance to turn away from this invitation from the EU. And then you had a movement of thousands of people in the streets risking their lives to say, no, that's not the future that we want. So we do have to remember that the prelude to this crisis is a key strategic ally of Russia really turning its back. And with all of the dynamics of the last several days in Kiev, in the capital of Ukraine, you still have the successor government to Yanukovych, essentially an anti-Russian government, calling on to the U.S. for support, looking west to Europe. I think the big choices, Putin has to decide how much he wants to risk, how much he wants to put on the table. Europe has to decide whether it's really willing to stand behind the people of Ukraine in what will be a very expensive effort to pull them from Russia towards Europe. I mean, if Russia offered $15 billion, you know, a couple times that anyway is going to be the cost of this effort.
David, obviously this nobody planned it to happen this way, but the fact that the administration decided to unveil its plans to scale back and kind of redesign the American military, It happens at the first of the week, and then all of this happens toward the end of the week. The question that I asked Secretary Hagel, how do you do that? And I think everybody knows we have to redesign the military now. But how do you do that without leaving the impression that we're withdrawing from the world and we're not aiming to be the kind of force we once were?
Well, first place, even if the plan were to keep the Army at its peak of 560,000, which is what it was at the height of Iraq and Afghanistan, there still wouldn't be any military options in Ukraine. So the plan to go down to 450,000 would not change your options in a place like Ukraine. The map dictates those options. But you still have the perception that you're going to a smaller force. And it's not just a smaller force, because the further we get away from Iraq and Afghanistan, the less battle-hardened a force it's going to be. The last time I was down at Fort Bragg, 16,000 of the 20,000 soldiers in the 82nd Airborne were combat veterans. 5 years from now, when the Army is smaller, that's not going to be the case. And I think the Army's plan and the Pentagon's plan is to keep deploying units to places like Africa for relatively small operations, but to show that the U.S. is still in the game. But look, if you were to take this vast, complex subject of defense strategy and the defense budget and boil it all down into a bumper sticker, it would be no more land wars in far-off lands. That's what the president is determining with this budget.
Well, Danielle, what about that? I mean, there does seem to be a perception in some parts of the world that the United States is stepping back.
I think there's a perception at this table that the United States is stepping back, not just in some parts of the world. You know, look, one of the reasons that you have a large and a capable and a multifaceted military is not so you can fight. It's so you don't have to fight. And that deterrent power, I think, is being diminished substantially. In addition, I'm hearing from inside the Pentagon that we're going down to numbers as low as 380,000 after the 450 that you mentioned. These are numbers that will make it impossible for us to engage not just in large-scale wars in one place, but in small-scale conflicts. People like Vladimir Putin know it. That's why it's so important for us at the end of the day on the previous conversation to ensure that things don't escalate in places like Ukraine, because the truth is that we've lost a lot of our deterrent power.
Michael?
Well, I'm comfortable with the 450,000 number, but I share Daniela's concern about where this could go next. If sequestration kicks back in 2 years, even the 2015 budget, which is dangerously close to sequestration, unless the increase that Obama and Hagel are requesting actually happens. This is a prescription for getting the Army down to 400,000 active duty soldiers and less. It's a lot of numbers. I know it's hard to grasp at what point you really get to a new threshold of capability. Let me put two missions on the table for you. We need to deter another Korean War. North Korea has 10 nuclear weapons, and they're probably trying to go up. Some people think of that as anachronistic. No, deterrence in Korea is as important as ever, which means you want the capability to handle that conflict along with our South Korean allies if it happens. Secondly, you've got to be ready for these smaller missions. And I guess I said there's just another one, that there are a lot of other possible ones, everything from a residual force in Afghanistan. What if we do get Israeli-Palestinian peace? That's going to require Americans to be part of an implementation force. What if we ever do get a peace deal in Syria? It seems off the charts now, but are we going to let this place blow up forever? And that may require international peacekeepers, including some Americans. So you got on the list, I think 450 is okay. We go much lower, I start to get very
worried. Well, and we haven't even talked about in the Pacific and what happens there. We're talking about a pivot toward the Pacific, but as I understand it, Secretary Hagel is also talking about reducing the number of ships in the Navy. Can we do that?
And a big part of his defense guidance was to say that he wants to build fewer what are called littoral combat ships, which were, in truth, the reason that he wants fewer is because he thinks the Chinese threat it may be more potent, and these ships are not strong enough, well-armed enough. I think if Secretary Hagel was to give his budget speech of last Monday today after the events in Ukraine and Crimea, it might have a slightly different tone. I mean, it's not as if the difference between 450,000 or 425,000 troops is the key signal. It's the way in which the United States backs up its statements so that they're credible. And I think, you know, looking at this situation, President Obama does have a credibility problem. He talks about a red line in Syria for chemical weapons, and then he lets it be blurred. He says that Russia will have to pay costs if it intervenes in Ukraine, and then within hours, the military intervention begins. So at some point, this issue of credibility and having the force and more the resolve to use it, I think, is crucial for the administration.
I think what you just said about Syria is exactly right. You know, we decided not to go into Syria because there was an agreement that Syria would give up its weapons, and they've given up, as yet, 11%. Okay? They were supposed to have given them all up. The fact that they are flouting this is, for me, a message that the president is sending to the rest of the world, which is, we're really not that interested in compliance. This is a storm that's blown over. These things do have implications, and it's part of the reason that Putin doesn't take us as seriously as he ought to when the Secretary of State comes out with a strong statement, because it's not backed up with the follow-through. And that's the risk that we really run in all of these places.
David, what are they most worried about at the Pentagon? You're there every day.
Well, in terms
they're
of the budget,
about you being
the budget, what they're worried about is that sequestration is still the law of the land, starting in 2016, and all of these cuts we've been talking about are just the beginning of really deep cuts if sequestration comes back in. So, but I'd like to just respond to the thing about Putin not taking us seriously. I mean, we had Hungary in 1954, Czechoslovakia in 1968, and Georgia in 2008. When the Soviet Union or Russia feels like the countries on its periphery are threatened, it takes action. And I don't think it really is determined by who's in the White House.
But we don't have a policy that Russia is allowed to have a near abroad. Okay, that was the Soviet policy. And at the end of the day, if we're willing to tolerate the notion that Russia has to dominate its neighbors, we have to ask ourselves, where that stops. If we're willing to tolerate the notion that Russia somehow has a say over where there's a Russian minority, even a substantial one, then we're looking at countries that are frankly part of NATO. We're looking at countries that we have an obligation to defend. We need to be decisive here so that they're not encouraged to go further.
All right. Well, I think we're going to end it there. We could probably talk all afternoon. Maybe we could all have brunch or something and work this out. Very, very enlightening this morning. Thanks to all of you on a very serious and a very important weekend. We'll be right back with a controversial Face the Nation interview straight out of the Cold War. No story has gotten more attention over the last half century than America's relationship with Russia. In fact, it was that story that produced Face the Nation's biggest and most controversial scoop.
Face the Nation. Through the eyes of CBS News film cameras located for the first time inside these walls of the Kremlin on Red Square in Moscow.
It was June 2nd, 1957, and Face the Nation was going to make history. After 2 years of dead-end negotiations, producers had managed to book the very first television interview with Soviet leader Nikita Khrushchev.
Mr. Khrushchev, we're very grateful to you for allowing us to come here. We have many questions that we want to put to you through your interpreter, and I'm very sure that you must have many answers to give us, which will be of great interest to millions of Americans.
Most of those answers proved unremarkable, but what made front pages around the world was the simple fact that Khrushchev, who had never been seen doing an interview by his own people, had been seen and heard in America's living rooms.
And I can prophesy that your grandchildren in America will live under socialism.
With Cold War tensions running high, some government officials accused CBS of putting out communist propaganda. Secretary of State Dulles refused to watch the interview. Even President Eisenhower, a staunch internationalist, suggested it was a phony exercise.
We know that there are no prepared questions here and no prepared answers. It is a matter of trying to deal honestly with each other and then putting it on the in the papers and on the radio and in the televisions, on the television screen. And this other performance of last Sunday afternoon was far from that.
Some in Congress even call for laws to keep foreign leaders off television unless the government gave permission. But CBS President Frank Stanton stood by the interview, and it came to be hailed as a journalistic milestone, establishing that broadcasters had the same right as newspapers to report the news without government interference. Back in a moment. Well, that's it for today. We want to thank you for joining us, and be sure to tune in to tonight's CBS Evening News and tomorrow to CBS This Morning for the very latest on this crisis in the Ukraine. For Face the Nation, I'm Bob Schieffer. We'll be back here next week. See you then.
This has been Face the Nation with CBS News Chief Washington Correspondent Bob Schieffer. Today's guests were Secretary of State John Kerry and Secretary of Defense Chuck Hagel. The executive producer of Face the Nation is Mary Hager, the senior producer is Rob Hendon, and the producer is Emily Bradley. This broadcast was directed by Sue Ann Stockey-Wayne from CBS News in Washington. For more Face the Nation, we're online at facethenation.com. And you can follow Face the Nation, Bob Schieffer, and CBS Radio News on Twitter, Google+, and Facebook.